Wir sind Theresa und
Nemo.
Und deshalb sind wir zu Shopify gewechselt.
Die Plattform, die wir vor Shopify verwendet haben, hat regelmäßig Updates gebraucht, die teilweise dazu geführt haben, dass der Shop nicht funktioniert hat.
Endlich macht unser Nemo-Boards-Shop dadurch auch auf den Mobilgeräten eine gute Figur. Und die Illustrationen auf den Boards kommen jetzt viel, viel klarer rüber, was uns ja auch wichtig ist und was unsere Marke auch ausmacht.
Starte deinen Test noch heute für 1 Euro pro Monat auf shopify.de/radio.
In a small Massachusetts town, 9 miles from downtown Boston, past a thicket of balding trees and roads less traveled, an epidemic has effectively wiped out half of its residents. But the population remains the same. I'm a reporter, freelance. You've never read anything by me. I've only just graduated from a small university in the area with a journalism degree. All it cost was my dignity and the indefinite forfeiture of all contents of my bank account. I'm always looking for work, investigative work, if you will. Best way to do that is to keep up with the news, local and national. Despite my financial situation, I shell out the money to keep my monthly subscription to a litany of newspapers, the New York Times, the Boston Globe, the Washington Post, and a few local papers from the greater Boston area. In that respect, and in that respect alone, the morning of November 2nd was no different than any other. Wake up, put on pants, struggle to carry the stack of papers that's accumulated on my doorstep, wash the ink smudges off my hands, and read as I drink a cuppa. I didn't see the story immediately. It was only after combing through most of the Boston Globe that I found the article tucked under the Metro section. The story has, for reasons which don't exactly elude me, since been removed from the Globe's website. Mother alleges child abuse in Warsham daycare. Underneath the headline, but above the alluring structure architecture of his text, was a picture of a woman in her early to mid-30s. Her face bore an expression of directionless grief, a bewildering sadness, familiar to those whose lives have been changed in an instant. Her arms, donned with cheap-looking bracelets, were draped with a gentle firmness around her daughter. I reflected on this only momentarily, before becoming completely transfixed on the girl in her grasp. The girl was young, too old to be a toddler, but too young to be an independent child, had long and frizzy blonde hair that pressed across a mother's arm the way broom bristles do when pressed against a hard wooden surface. Her eyes glared into the camera, a light blue penetration that sent a chill through my body and brought about a sudden and inexplicable lightheadedness. I waited for it to subside and continued onto the article. Only in retrospect do I understand what the lightheadedness had been. It was a warning, my body signaling to me that something was wrong. Oh, so wrong. A nudge from the primal and knowing but unconscious and involuntary corner of my brain that links us to our primordial survivalist ancestors, the very same that galvanized them into action when the choice in front of them was often between fight and flight, between life and death. On some level, I must have known this. So why did I continue to look? For the same reason drivers will rubberneck as they pass a gruesome and likely fatal pileup on the highway. It is a light and distanced brush with death, the inevitable unknowability. There is something attractive about encroaching the unknowns and the unknowables, to dip one toes into the void. What was that quote my philosopher major and pretentious jackass college roommate had written on our shared whiteboard? The one by Nietzsche? If you gaze into the abyss will gaze back into you, or something to that effect. In the girl's eyes was an abyss, and my eyes were gazing with a focused intensity I've never known before. But Nietzsche was wrong. It felt as though the abyss was looking through me, and that was far, far worse. I trudged onto the article. My stomach was now a solidified mass in the pit of my abdomen, and acid began to sting my throat. My heart beat loudly, as though in protest, but I ignored it and read on. Brenda McCarthy, a 32-year-old Warsham resident and mother, took a 5-year-old daughter to the same daycare last week as she had done every workday for the past 3 years. But something deeply troubled her when she picked up Ellie McCarthy that afternoon. It wasn't her, Brenda told me in her home as she fought the onset of tears. My baby girl looked so confused, so distant, and she just didn't seem like herself. When asked what she meant by that, Brenda fell silent for a few moments, perhaps in hesitation, before calling her daughter to me. Ellie McCarthy walked up to her silently, without any of the energy typical for a 5-year-old child. She turned her face upwards at me, with no emotion registered on a young face. Her mother burst into tears. After she regained her composure, Brenda told me that Ellie had exhibited a series of strange behavior since the car ride home from the daycare. At first, Brenda explained to me, I suspected that she was tired, took it out, you know, from a day of playing. She is, or she was, a social and sweet girl, but she wasn't sleeping. Her eyes were open, wide open, like she was in shock, like she had seen a ghost. I thought, oh, she must have gotten into an argument with Lexi, her best friend from the daycare. So I asked her if she was okay. You know what she said to me? The tears once again pooled in her eyes and threatened to spill again. But she persisted through them. She said, there's something strange about the daycare lady. She was acting all funny. I asked Brenda if she had said anything else, and she shook her head. She just repeated herself over and over. Her face, she looked so scared, like she was traumatized, hopeless. I pulled the car over and got out and went over to her side. She had no visible bruises or scars, but her stare remained. She trembled at my touch. I observed Ellie as her mother recanted these events. Her eyes remained fixed on me as her mother sobbed and held her. Her mother continued describing her suspicion that the so-called daycare lady, a 23-year-old Mary Harris, had psychologically damaged and abused the young child. She intends to litigate and believes she has standing to sue the daycare for damages. She says she is working to get in contact with other parents of children in the daycare to build a stronger case. Below the story was contact information for a lawyer's office, undoubtedly Mrs. McCarthy's. I looked at the byline. I was not surprised to see the story had been written by Elizabeth Collett. Her writing style had become familiar to me, and she was a journalist I highly respected. Call it journalistic instinct. I shall not, as I do not think so highly of myself. But there was something fundamentally strange, something deeper than misplaced trust in a daycare worker. I didn't know what it was, but my intuition nagged at me and assured me there was. If I had known what I was going to uncover, I would have immediately packed everything I could fit into a suitcase and left everything behind. But journalists do journalism for the same reason a mongoose will attack and eat snakes. It's instinct, and instinct pays little regard to safety, because not every mongoose lives through an encounter with their food. With this in mind, I made my way to grab my keys off the kitchen counter. As I did, I took another look at the article, looked into Ellie's eyes, and shuddered. Begin with what you know and fill in what you don't. For me, that was the first and only rule of journalism. What I knew was that I needed to speak with the McCarthys. I found their address with relative ease. On my way to my car, I searched for Brenda McCarthy under the property search tab on the county appraisal website, found their address and, lucky for me, they lived 5 minutes away. I made it in 3. I parked on the street, locked my car, and approached what would have undoubtedly made the cover of the fall edition of Middle Class Suburbia magazine. A garden of wilting brown roses peppered the front of the house next to a doormat, asking the Lord above to bless this mess. I made a mental note of what I saw. a good journalist is never off duty, and raised my hand to knock on the door. Brendan McCarthy opened the door as my fist was raised to knock on it. This didn't surprise me as much as her appearance did. In the days since the interview, she looked as though she had aged 30 years. The bags under her eyes were imprinted markings, and veins painted a map-like navigation system across the pockets. Her eyes bulged out of her skull, beady and glazed over marbles that seemed not to register my presence. The skin on her face was pressed against her skull, pulled taut. If a skilled anatomy student had accompanied me, he would have been able to name every bone in the poor woman's face. The lightheadedness returned, and the borders of my vision turned a light grey haze. "Don't you dare pass out," I thought. "You're here for answers. This is just another question." I did my best to stabilize myself before I could produce any sound. "Hi, Mrs. McCarthy. My name is Eli. I'm a reporter. I wanted to follow up with a story from the Globe. There's something strange about my daughter. About Ellie. She's acting different." Her lips had barely moved as she spoke. If a skilled ventriloquist observed alongside the skilled anatomy student, he would have been green with envy, as the expression goes. "Strange... how?" I paused. Then added, "May I come in and ask you a few questions?" Under her breath, I heard a nearly silent, "There's something strange about my daughter, about El..." before it trailed off, although I had a guess as to the rest of what she said. She turned and walked with an unsettling gait, extending her left foot outwards and scuttling her right foot along. She continued to mutter under her breath as she did so. And stupidly, I followed her. Without a word, Mrs. McCarthy sat on the lover's seat in a sofa, placed her hand gently but dispassionately on her lap, and set a gaze once more on me. The sinking feeling of looking into that little girl's eyes returned, and anxiety molded itself into a ball and settled deep into my stomach. It was like peering off a cliff at the top of a large mountain and acknowledging that, with one misstep, life ends and death begins indefinitely. That feeling of slow recognition that it could all end, and a pull towards that end. The nerve endings of my fingertips began to tingle, and then, in a flash, raced down my arms like lightning striking a metal rod. But I had to fulfill my stupid journalistic duties, and so I sat down on the coffee table, directly in front of what was left of Brendan McCarthy at 201 Bedford Street. I grabbed the pen and small journal from my coat pocket. I suddenly felt stupid for bringing it at all. How the hell was I going to write this? I looked at Brenda, just below her eyes. It was easier than looking into the abyss. My stomach settled a bit, and my head descended back onto my neck. I gulped once and asked the question again. "Mrs. McCarthy, what exactly is happening with your daughter?" She said nothing. Her eyes said nothing, and she seemed as though she withered to nothing. I tried a different approach. "Quite frankly, Brenda, you look like a mess. You've lost an impossible amount of weight, and I need some answers. Not as a journalist, Brenda. I'm concerned for your safety." Manipulative, sure, but not untrue. She looked emaciated, but I'm not proud of saying what I said. Not like it ended up mattering anyway. She gave me nothing. Not a single damn facial expression or flicker of discernible emotion. The only movement on her face was a light pulse of her eyes as they bulged from their pulled back sockets. Nothing. A blank stare, emotionless, and so eerily still. The tingling in my fingertips returned, and my heart began to thrash wildly in my chest as my breath became shorter and shorter still. something was wrong with this woman, and she needed medical attention. The thought exited my mind as quickly as it entered, because it was replaced by the incomprehensible reality that I was forced to immediately accept. To my right was the pale and starved and decaying body of 5-year-old Ellie McCarthy. A trail of blood stained the carpet under what remained of her head as it was dragged into the room where her mother and I sat. Her mouth was fixed in a constant gape, and her eyes stared lifelessly, listlessly, towards the ceiling, a fossil of her final moments on this earth. My mind processed a disordered and uneven array of thoughts, of flashes that came with the intensity and duration of muscle spasms. Not in words, but images, intangible neon danger, alerting the psyche. Shots of fear signaled alongside my neural pathway in frantic and unfamiliar patterns. The tingling was all over now, and my head felt light enough to float several yards above my body. My mouth began producing excess saliva, and I feared I would expel my stomach contents on the floor. Thud. The hand released the body of the little girl, and it produced a damp thud that made me jump in my seat. Brenda McCarthy kept as still as the deceased. I calmed myself, looked at the figure that brought the body into the room, and immediately screamed. Next to the corpse of the younger McCarthy was a figure that resembled Ellie McCarthy. Her hand dirtied with the leaking blood of the body next to her. It was a very much alive Ellie McCarthy, dragging an obviously not alive Ellie McCarthy into the room. But there was something strange about her. They share the resemblance of twins, perhaps even clones, if that technology indeed exists. Physically, in other words, they were damn near identical. The frizzy blonde hair seemed to cut and paste. The bridge of her nose arced the same way as the girl in the picture. Hell, I'm pretty sure the number of freckles she had matched the number from the dead girl slumped next to her. But it wasn't her. I could tell. I knew from looking at her, into her eyes, into the abyss, that it was not Ellie McCarthy. It was a caricature, a cheap, off-brand imitation, meant to pass off as a living and breathing and thinking and loving human being. Conscious thought awoke again. Only a sliver of it, but enough, and I realized I needed to get out of here now. I made quickly for the door, stopping once to look over my shoulder. Just like Lot's wife, I thought hysterically. Brenda's lips were pulled back. Rotting, coal black gums, flecked with white bone protrusions from her teeth, a rotted, cheddar yellow, with Swiss-like holes, stuck out jaggedly as she produced what can only be loosely defined as a grin. As I closed the door and ran out, I swear I heard her tell me that there was something strange about her daughter, and that she was acting differently. I drove towards nothing in particular, and without intention. Police, I thought. I have to go to the police. And tell them what? There's a dead body, a girl, and a mother is clearly sick, and they need my help, and what? Go to the police. Tell them you found a dead body being dragged by a carbon copy of the dead girl, and let them think what exactly. Damn, Brenda could be dead by the time they get there. Would they even find a murder weapon? They'd probably wonder why I went there at all. What, because of some hunch about a random back cover news story? They'll think I'm insane. And there'll be 2 dead bodies and no witnesses. Damn. Okay, let's relax. Police is out of the question, I said to my empty Honda Accord. But I can't do nothing. I have to talk to someone. Elizabeth Colleet, famed Boston Globe reporter. I blinked. Yes, Elizabeth. I could talk to her, couldn't I? She'd gone to the house, seen the child, spoken with Brenda, maybe she felt that feeling of dread when looking into Ellie's eyes, past them into the nothingness where her soul should have been. I set my GPS to the address for the globe and made a U-turn. If I had continued driving, I could have driven onto the highway and continued until I left Massachusetts. But instead, I shared the final moments of Boston Globe's Elizabeth Kalit's 42-year existence on Earth. "You don't understand." Nor had I expected her to. But there was a certain Boston area reporter that I had to see. Much to my chagrin, the front desk lady stood her ground. "Sir, I'm sorry. Unless you have an appointment, you'll have to leave." She wrinkled her nose as she said this, then extended a hand towards the door. Ugh, I was getting nowhere with her, and time was marching forward, and the body of a little girl rotted and chilled not 10 miles from here. So I went ahead anyway. The surprised cries of, "Sir, sir, you can't go in there," barely registered through my determination. And before I knew it, I'd found the room with a door-adjacent plaque labeled Elizabeth Kalit. As I placed my hand on the doorknob to open it, a cold hand grabbed my shoulder firmly and spun me around. It was her. In the flesh. Under different circumstances, I would have been starstruck. A journalistic giant in my presence. But I was on a mission, and lives depended on me. "Excuse me, can I help you?" She spoke with a thick Boston accent. Her eyes narrowed at me, and her brow furrowed. Her tongue stuck out the tiniest bit and licked the right, then left, corners of her thinning lips. The front desk lady stood impatiently behind me, arms crossed, an expression furious. Yeah. Her hand still locked onto my shoulder, with the clammy grip of an arcade claw. The name's Elijah Dears. I'm here about the story you wrote about Brenda McCarthy and Ellie McCarthy? I gulped, my mouth suddenly dry and my throat suddenly raw. Her eyes remained fixated in a suspicious slit, her hand on my shoulder. But across her face was the tiniest flicker of emotion. Was it validation? Did she see as I did? I thought it might be. If she had survived, I think I might have asked her. "Ah, yes. The daycare abuse story practically wrote itself." Daycare came out as daycare, something I would have found mildly amusing under different circumstances. What struck me was what I detected beyond her words. Her voice sounded aloof, but her eyes remained interested. "What about it?" Elizabeth Kalit was invested and wanted to have the whole story. She was a good journalist. So I provided a SparkNotes edition of the past several hours, omitting the unnecessary and focusing on the crucial. As I told her, the grip on my shoulder tightened and, when I told her of Ellie McCarthy's fate, her grip tightened into a squeeze that sent a not totally unpleasant chill down the small of my back. When I concluded, there was silence. There was no movement. Out of the corner of my eye, I saw the front desk lady standing completely still, arms dangling at her sides. Finally, Elizabeth Kalit spoke. "Let me see if I understand. You expect me to believe that some barely graduate college student playing journalist tracked down a grieving mother and an abused daughter based on a hunch about a news story he read?" She loosened the grip a bit. "And when he gets there, get this, he finds the dead daughter and the mother looking like a Holocaust survivor. And, oh wait, let's not forget the best part. Next to the body of the dead little McCarthy child was the same kid, but alive. Deborah, you hearing this?" The front desk lady, Deborah, didn't respond. "I'll give you this. You got balls. But they're good for nothing if you don't got the brains too." She released a hand from its resting place on my shoulder and spoke her final words as Elizabeth Kalit, Pulitzer Prize nominee and human resident of Massachusetts. "I'll grant you something though. I smelled something peculiar about that house, but if I saw two of the same person, you bet your ass I would have written about it. Deborah, let's see about getting this young man. As she turned her face to look at Deborah, her mouth opened as if she was yawning, and her eyebrows cocked downwards. I turned to look. The whites of Deborah's eyes had been stained a deep black that streaked across in irregular patterns like spilled ink on clear canvas. Her face had turned paper white, her lips translucent and cracked in jagged, vein-like patterns. Her gaze was fixed on a point somewhere between and beyond where Elizabeth and I stood. Elizabeth looked at me, and then back at her. I think she looked into her eyes, and began to sway as I did when I peered into that abyss. And, without change to her expression or stance, she began to vomit. Her expulsions had a bulby, yolk-yellow appearance, hard centers amidst runny goo. It made a sickening splat as it landed on the ground, and a wave of nausea flooded my senses. I thought I might faint. The feeling worsened when I realized what it was that Deborah was projectile vomiting. I shadowed a surgeon for part of a surgery for a story I was writing in class for college. I had seen this before. Adipose tissue. Fat. She was throwing up her fat. Her face began to thin, her skin pulling back taut on her face, as though held back by clothespins. The black in her eyes danced like clouds during a thunderstorm. Yet, she stood still. Oh, so perfectly still. Motionless. Then, all at once, the vomiting ceased. A shallow pool of fat had amassed underneath her feet. A shallow, bubbly pool of organic mass. At first, the tissue remained formless. Until it didn't. Slowly. So slowly, in fact, that I was unsure if I had imagined it. The fat began to pull together and amassing in smaller clumps, then bigger ones. An image of Play-Doh being rolled up into balls came to mind as I teetered and tottered and struggled to find solid ground to stand on. The lightheadedness had returned, and I suddenly felt myself at a distance from my body. My heart began to beat rapidly, and my breath became shorter. A surge of adrenaline shot through me, and I remember one lone conscious thought. I have to get the hell out of here. I screamed, completely involuntary, and turned to Elizabeth, intent on grabbing her and running to my car with her. She stood completely still, eyes fixed on the mass of organic matter in front of her that was beginning to vaguely resemble her former employee. Oh no. I managed to speak as loudly as I could muster. It came out as barely louder than a whisper. Elizabeth. There's something strange about my employee, Deborah. She's acting strange. Her Boston accent had completely disappeared. Her voice delivering a line like a bad drama high school drama student. Monotone. Dispassionate. Oh no. Oh no. I looked into her eyes and found myself sinking into the same abyss I discovered at the McCarthy household. On the border of her eyes, I saw trails of blackness circling around like a whirlpool, flushing closer and closer to the middle of her vision. There's something strange about Deborah. She's acting all strange. Elizabeth was gone. I knew that. But I hesitated before leaving her. She looked the same, for now, but something was wrong. And so I took off. I gagged as I stepped into the puddle of what would become Deborah, the front desk lady. A smell I'll never forget. I ran to my car, fumbled for my keys and got in. A bit of Deborah's fat had stuck to the bottom of my shoe, and the smell lingered. I took off my shoe, lowered the driver's side window and tossed it. The smell was never coming off. I sped down the parking lot, hitting a few parked cars in the lot. I didn't care. As I turned onto Needham Street, a sight imprinted onto my brain. globs of fatty tissue molded, various models of humanoid beings in various configurations and expressions. All were represented, different phases of development abound. Many were embryonic, in relative terms, recently vomited adipose cells that had begun to clump at the heel of the foot to create the base of the human they just left. Others were legs and a bottom, torso either missing or in the works, but sure to come soon. Some were fully formed beings, standing next to the emaciated corpses of their previous owners, who now lay dead on the street. The coloration step seemed to be the last one, when they began to adopt the skin tones of their owner. I saw very few that were anything other than the sickly egg yolk yellow with flakes of dried blood peppering the hardening tissue. The ones that were fully formed stood there, as still as the dead. Motionless, their dead selves lay next to them. In a disjointed chorus, I heard several names, followed by some iteration of acting strange, or seem peculiar, or look quaint. Cars were strewn about, trails of yellow guck lining the still open doors and amassing at a critical point. It was a massacre. I turned onto I-90 and drove non-stop until I thought it was safe to stop. In other words, I drove for a while. If I had to estimate at this point, I would say nearly half of the residents of Warsham have been replaced. Maybe more, I'm not sure. It appears to be contagious, but if it is contagious, why have I not begun to change? I've been exposed to several carriers. I looked into their eyes. Is it possible that I'm immune? Am I capable of peering into the abyss without joining it? And if so, are there others like me? Maybe. Of that, I have no way to be sure. I would not stake a life on it. So please, if you hear someone describing that a co-worker, or loved one, or friend is acting strange, or funny, or different, or odd, run. That appears to be the first sign. Do not look into their eyes. Do not communicate with them. Pack whatever you think you'll need to survive for a long period of time, and pack it as quickly as you can, and leave. It started in Massachusetts, and I don't think that's where it'll end.
Wir sind Theresa und
Nemo
und deshalb sind wir zu Shopify gewechselt.
Die Plattform, die wir vor Shopify verwendet haben, hat regelmäßig Updates gebraucht, die teilweise dazu geführt haben, dass der Shop nicht funktioniert hat.
Endlich macht unser Nemo-Boards-Shop dadurch auch auf den Mobilgeräten eine gute Figur und die Illustrationen auf den Boards kommen jetzt viel, viel klarer rüber, was uns ja auch wichtig ist und was unsere Marke auch ausmacht.
Starte deinen Test noch heute für 1 Euro pro Monat auf shopify.de/radio.